Welcome to the second day of our Samba XP. I hope you are all well rested and had a pleasant night. As you already noticed, this is Chris Hertel. He is with Ubix and he's also the Samba team member, and he will talk to you about his last vacation.
Right.
So it's all yours.
All right, before I get started, the reason I have this up, I wanted to thank Kai for putting me onto these. This is the Seagate Free Agent Dockstar, and if you haven't had a chance to play with a device like this, they're a lot of fun. They're based on a Marvell design that's based originally on the PogoPog, is that right? ShivaPog was the original, that's right, and PogoPog was one of the follow-ons. Seagate put this device out as a docking bay for their Dockstar, or their Free Agent hard drives, and they didn't like it much, so they went and did a new design, and they kind of sold these off cheaply. And just about that time, people figured out you could crack them and run them as your own little Linux box, and they were about $30 a pop. I got four of them, $30 US. That's got to be even less in euros. I'm not sure what that would be, 20 euros or something like that. And what happened was, just about a week after I discovered these things and got four of them for myself, the rest of the net found them too, and the price jumped to 78. Okay? I mention that because it's a great testing platform. This is a little, I'm doing a finger here. I'm using Netcat to do finger, but I'm doing a finger. I wrote a little daemon, and this is over VPN. I'm sending a finger command to my Dockstar over the net, and the finger command responds with a script I wrote at the other end. So just as a, basically the output of top and that kind of thing. But that's in Minnesota that's coming through. And the other thing I can do with it, which I think is really cool, is I'm running a BZFlag server on it. This is, again, on a little Dockstar unit. At my desk in Minnesota over a VPN connection. And this is one of the things, the reason I bring it up is it's one of the things that I played with while I wasn't allowed to work on SIFS. Takes it a second, but there, once we get going, this is all being served. Of course, the graphics are all being done locally, but the information is all being served off of that unit back in Minnesota, that little $30 ARM-based unit. Whoops, somebody's shooting at me from behind. See? Woo. Ah, they got me. All right. All right, so we can give that up now, and we can get going on the real thing. So, SIFS Geeks in Exile, what we did on our holiday. So, quick introduction. I have a piece of music here, but it's not working properly, so I'll skip it. But basically, if you don't know who I am by now, you will never know me. I'm your friendly neighborhood SIFS geek. If you've been working in the SIFS protocol, you've been working with things I've written, either that or you're not paying attention. 10 years ago, pardon?
That's most of it.
10 years ago, I put out a book on SIFS, the protocol itself, not on Samba or on using or configuring Windows or anything else, on the SIFS protocol itself. I started a project a while before that called JSIFS, a Java client implementation. That project is still going. It's not going very quickly, but it's still going. I joined in 97, the Samba team, I believe it was. Incurable idealist. I think Tom can attest to that down there. And there's all sorts of other things that you probably have heard about me.
You appear to have broadly pollinated that person.
And I do. I do, actually, you see. But I was tainted because in 2007 I was contacted by a company called Microsoft. They had read my book, apparently, strange stuff, and they decided that I might be a good candidate to help them write their SIFS documentation, their official specifications. I formed a company with my wife, and we hired some people, and we wrote the specifications. I was the lead author. Tom is now in charge of those docs, so anything that's wrong is now his fault. Halfway, that's true. Halfway through, you took charge, and I appreciated it actually, Tom. It was nice being able to work with you. MS SIFS and MS SMB. I have no responsibility for MS SMB 2, thankfully. But MS SIFS and MS SMB were the documents we produced. And these, of course, are names you can search for on the web and find and download. And there you have your specifications for these protocols. During the time that we were working on this, I had access to Microsoft's internal information. Microsoft, again, to their credit, and I appreciate this from them, worked very hard with me before we started the contract to make sure that there was an exit, that there was a sunset, that there was an end, and that I would be able to return to doing what I'd like to do best, which is explain how this stuff works. Right, to as many people as I can, either commercially or openly, whichever way I can get away with doing it. But that meant that once I was done with the contract, I still had a one year NDA, essentially. I wasn't allowed to work on any specific SIFS implementation for 1 year. And the basic reason for that was they didn't want some company to come to me and say, hey, you know, we're working on a SIFS implementation. We'll pay you lots of money if you will come and tell us what you learned from Microsoft. You know?
And you didn't put it all in the document.
I did put it all in the document, as a matter of fact. Tom had to take a lot of it out. But I did put it all in the document because that's the kind of guy I am. But I will tell you that, quite honestly, and it was Thomas Fenning who said that this is the concern, I did have companies come to me and say, if you worked for us, you could give us all the secrets you learned, and nobody else would have them. And I said, you know, that's, first of all, not what I would do. And second of all, you know, I can't. So that year, however, ended May 1st. What's wrong, Tom? You're looking at it funny. Oh, okay. That year ended May 1st. I think that's what we it kind of really ended mid-April, but we agreed on May 1st, and
whatever you said.
So I am now free. So anybody wants to, talk to me afterwards.
You weren't free?
No, I'm free to work now. I'm free to work. But I had that whole year to do things. And so this presentation is all about what I did during that 1 year. And to give you a basic overview, here's our introduction overview here, our outline. I worked on Linux clusters with the goal that eventually I'd be working on Samba clusters. Haven't gotten to the Samba cluster part yet, but we're working on Linux clusters with GFS2 as our underlying system. We're trying to work with virtual clusters as a testing platform. I worked on something called the BITS protocol. Actually, it's the BITS upload protocol. That's not quite correct. There isn't exactly a BITS protocol, and I'll explain that later. There is a BITS upload protocol. And I worked on Microsoft's branch cache, on understanding it, and most recently on starting to implement the protocols there. So let's talk about the Linux cluster work I did real quickly, because I'm interested in... I mean, the main goal here is to get other people interested in the work I'm doing and hopefully build some momentum and get more people involved. I chose GFS2. How many people are familiar with GFS2? Anybody? Okay. The reason I chose GFS2 is that there are several reasons, actually. First of all, it's an in-kernel system, file system. It's in the kernel. It's accepted into the kernel. There's support for it in the kernel. The kernel developers are aware of it. It's there. It's part of the Red Hat cluster suite, supported also in Fedora. So whenever you download a copy of Fedora, there's, the capability of running a cluster is there. It's ready for you to use. Things like Ubuntu and such don't include that. SUSE includes something else. I think it's based on Oracle's OCFS, but I'm not sure. I haven't actually looked at it, so I don't know. But it seemed a viable option because Red Hat was supporting it. The other thing about it is that the project originally started, the project that became GFS2, originally started where I used to work, which is the University of Minnesota. I know the founder, the creator of the project. I worked for him for a year and a half, as a matter of fact. And I know the group at Red Hat that that is working on this project because they are all still local. They're in Minneapolis, which is a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota. Yeah. Anyway, so it was, for me, it was a good community choice. I knew the people. GFS2 is part of the Linux infrastructure. It seemed like a very good choice as far as something to work on that would be part of the Linux community. And that's why it seemed to work for me. And the other thing about it, and there's a but down here, the other thing about it is that there are people here at CERNET who have tried to work with GFS2 as a cluster platform. And well, what Volker told me specifically was that he tried for 3 days and gave up. Right? And I thought, well, since I know these people at Red Hat and I've worked with some of them, maybe I should help them help everybody by getting this to work right. All right. So it was a good choice for those reasons. There are several other choices out there. I know a Samba team member who is trying to work with Ceph. The last time I looked at Ceph was a while back, but a few months back. But at the time, it was still listed as a work in progress, not ready for prime time. And Kai is nodding and kind of saying, yeah, that's where it is. Okay. Gluster. Gluster is very, very powerful right now. It's got a lot of momentum. A lot of people are interested in it. It's fast. It's got a lot of, it can handle a lot of capacity. The complaint I've heard about it, again, from the team at CERNET who have been working with these things, is that it has some cluster, some cache consistency errors. That there are problems if you go between two nodes of the cluster, they may not be completely in sync. And so that's a concern there, although that's probably the second most interesting one as far as I'm concerned, because it might be something that's fixable. I don't know. Particularly with CTDB there, we might be able to work around that issue. I have not tested MooseFS. You have. Okay. Any comments?
Well, same problem as Ceph, not ready for CTDB.
Fair enough. Okay, so the comment was that same problem as Ceph, it's not ready for CTDB. All right? And then OCFS, it's the Oracle Cluster File System. I know some history here. The story goes that the Oracle people showed up at a company called Sestina in Minnesota, which was the creator of GFS before it was GFS2. By the way, when I say GFS, I mean Global File System, not Google File System. There are a couple of GFSs out there. Oracle showed up, looked at it, thought it was interesting, went back and wrote their own. That's the story I hear. You know, after hours, you know, when I get together with these guys. Wikipedia has a longer list of people, of projects out there trying to create systems like this for Linux. So my short-term goal actually was to just build a cluster and run Samba on it. That was my original goal, okay? That was my hope. A couple of months ago, there was a conference call between the Red Hat group, myself, Jeremy and Volker and Michael Adam and a few other people who are working on this stuff. And Volker and Jeremy voiced the opinion. It was actually, I think, proposed by one of the Red Hat people that, and Volker and Jeremy liked the idea that what should be done was that a script should be created to generate a virtual cluster in a box so that we could do testing. Because if you have a good, strong, single machine, and you can create a cluster of three or four virtual nodes, and they can run as a cluster, then for a Samba developer, like myself, Kai, or anybody else, this is a very quick and easy way to create a cluster that you can use for testing. Right? So that was the idea. And what I can tell you is a very successful in the sense that the script was written in a very short time frame. I ran it, the first beta of the script, and it worked. It created a cluster on a testing machine I had. All the nodes ran, and then it created a GFS2 shared file system underneath, and that was great. And I did some basic testing, create a directory, I can see it on all nodes, you know, add a file to the directory, I can read it on all nodes. Very nice, very quick to get that part done. It took, you know, 40 minutes to generate all the file systems and everything else, but it did it all in the background, and I didn't have to worry about it. I just started it running and then went off and did something else and came back, and it was, you know, it was done after a while. Based on Fedora 14, so you can do it all for free. Runs with KVM, QEMU. Very nice. The problem, the script works, but the problem is when you stress GFS2 in this environment. Remember, we're using a shared disk, okay, a shared virtual disk in a virtual machine cluster. You stress GFS2 in this environment, and the file system hangs. And that's the current status of this project, that we're stuck with the problem that in the virtual environment, the file system hangs. And we don't know why yet. Although the Red Hat people who are, you know, the cluster developers, we think we have it. We've got a fix. It's coming through, and it should be available in a couple of weeks. And that's, you know, as of today, where we are. So the fix is in the works, and we'll see where that goes. But again, the current goal is to do the cluster in a box script. In the program, and when I originally submitted this talk, I talked about how I would go into detail. But the fact is that the details have changed very rapidly. And so this is as much detail as I really have for you. The long-term goal is to get Samba CTDB running on top of GFS2, write a how-to so that it's easy for anybody to set this up, have the CBOX script running, and successfully creating virtual clusters. And then, once all that's going, move to real hardware clusters. And the final goal is we want to be able to run production clusters with Samba and NFS running on top of GFS2. Right now, there are three different how-tos. There's the one I wrote, the one Red Hat wrote, and then the one that Red Hat wrote, gave to Michael Adam that he fixed in a lot of places. Michael Adam is the person from Cernet, Samba team member, who has done the most, I think, as far as actually building clusters, and added a tremendous amount of information to the how-to. Part of my job is to take all these different how-tos and combine them into one. Red Hat, of course, has built running hardware clusters, so they know that part works. We haven't yet done any performance testing on these. And right now the focus is on the cluster-in-a-box virtual clusters. So I don't have any numbers for you yet because we haven't gotten that far in the testing. So the interesting thing, I think, in conclusion to all this is that I was talking to some people recently. Actually, I was talking to some people about, you know, doing a business based on this model. Build clusters. You can do this work, get everything working, build hardware clusters, something you can, you know, buy and slam into a rack, and now you have a Samba cluster.
I thought you had four nodes, $30 each. You're good to go.
Well, you know, the cluster system doesn't actually run on 32-bit platforms. So they've got it all tuned for 64-bit, and you know, but I'm thinking about those. You could do some really interesting clustering work with those little devices. You know, yeah, no, that's interesting stuff. Kai's already done some work with that, and you know, yeah, but you know, I was talking to some people, and the question came up in a very, very sensible question: why does anybody really want a cluster? You know, there are people who do, but how many of those are there, and is it really the right solution? What are we looking for from a cluster? We're looking for failover. You want to have a lack of interruption of service. If a machine goes down, a server goes down, goes in tight. If a server goes down, you don't want the customer, the client, to actually even notice. And that's interesting because the SMB protocol doesn't really handle that kind of failover very well at all. SMB2 does, right? So if you're going to do this kind of cluster and you want to run SMB protocols, you really want to be running SMB2. SMB2 knows how to reconnect, but SMB does not. So that's an interesting problem you have to look at if you're thinking of making a production cluster. How is it really going to work? Is it really going to help you in the failover department? And the answer is only if you're running Vista and above. Okay? You want active-active load balancing. But the protocols still are stateful, which is why you need CTDB. You need to have that shared state between the cluster nodes. So it's doable. You know, active-active load balancing, you can do it. Okay? And you want scalability. You want to be able to say, oh, throw some more nodes at it and see if it'll work better. And that becomes a problem when you're dealing with the cluster file system, because a lot of the cluster file systems scale up to a certain point and stop. It doesn't get better just by adding more nodes. It actually slows things down because you have to do more communication between more nodes. So these are the goals that we'd be trying to meet. And the important thing is to make sure you're looking at these goals as you build your cluster, not just building a cluster for the sake of building a cluster. Okay? And are there better ways to meet these goals? That's another important question that I think deserves a lot of time to examine. Okay. Are there any questions on the clustering stuff I've done so far? I mean, this is the basic groundwork I'm doing to make it easier, hopefully, for other people to do clusters. Anybody got anything? Don't be shy about interrupting me anywhere along this, because the whole point of this is to make sure you guys have as much interesting information, hopefully it's interesting, as I can give you. No? Okay. Then we'll go on. Bits. Background intelligent transfer service. Okay? I got this off of a blog at Microsoft. Bits is Earth's most widely used file transfer service, with more than 600 million unique users across the planet. That's really exciting. That's really exciting stuff. So, note well, nobody cares. Okay? Okay, nobody cares, and why? Because, well, let's take a look at what this really means. Notice that this statement up here, while it may be true, does not say protocol. It says file transfer service. Bits is the service, the Windows system service. Pardon me. Bits is the Windows system service that is used by Windows Update, Microsoft Update, etc., to download patches, service packs, that kind of thing in the background. You know, it says you may continue working while the transfer is continuing in the background. Yeah, you ever see that? Because of this thing called Bits. Transfer service, all right? Most users don't know it's there. It's not a thing that people use because it's fun or interesting or powerful. It's something that people use because Windows tells you to. Windows just does, okay? It's built into Windows. These are the features. It's built into Windows, therefore it gets used. It does restartable transfers. If you shut down your machine halfway through a transfer, it doesn't care. When you start up again, it'll go back out and continue the download. Okay? The transfer restarts, however, are linear. Okay, so if you've copied this much of the file, you can't grab some over here, you can't fill in the gap here, you can't, it's all, well, I did this much, so I start again here and I keep going. All right, until I get the whole thing done. So unlike something like rsync, which can say, oh, well, things changed, and I'll fix it to make the changes match and everything else, it's a very linear copy. All right? It does do both download and upload, and that's the part that surprises people. It also has something called upload reply, which I'll explain in a minute. There are job priority levels. You can have, low priority, medium priority, foreground priority, where it's got to get done right now. But the key feature is that it senses network traffic in order to manage the impact that it has on other activity going on. The download jobs are the overwhelming majority. And most of the stuff you see from Bits is download jobs. Download is basically HTTP, HTTPS. That's all it is. So really, it's sort of like UUCP. It's something that kind of happens in the background, and you get files transferred. And, you know, or another way to look at it would be a combination of wget run as a batch job with a nice value to lower it down, and diffserv to make sure that it's the lowest priority network traffic. If you're familiar with diffserv, I don't know. But, you know, that's one way to look at it. The special sauce really is that network monitoring. And basically, Microsoft has some sort of proprietary method of trying to guess how much free bandwidth there is so that it uses only that free bandwidth and never impacts any other transfer going on. So your user experience is never impacted. All right? I don't find that part particularly interesting. That's not what I'm working on. Upload jobs. These are much less common. They use proprietary extensions to HTTP, HTTPS. So this is something where things get different now. And so far, the only places that you can do this are between Bits clients and Windows HTTP, HTTPS servers. Until now. So STIB, which means sipping tea in Belgium, or something like that. STIB is what it is. It's a little kit that I wrote for testing Bits uploads. It's a little tool. You can download the code and compile it on Linux. I've tried it on BSD and it doesn't work, so use Linux. The example code is ready for anybody to play with. It's, you know, documented internally. It's not the cleanest thing. It's my first draft. However, it works. It works nicely. It would be very easy, based on the code I've written, to look at that code, and if you were an Apache developer or something like that, you could write a CGI, or not even an Apache developer, but you could write a CGI script to do Bits uploads. It's really a simple protocol. So using what I've got so far, plus the documentation that's out there, Apache could be extended to be a Bits upload server as well as a download server, which it already is. Bits upload extensions. Basically, there's a new method added to HTTP called bits underscore post. So when the request goes up, that first line will have bits underscore post in it, and that will identify it as a bits upload request. And then within that, there are these six commands. There's a ping. Ping is a one-off. You send a ping, it gives you a response. Yes, I'm running bits. That's it. There is a create session, which says, I want to send a file to you now. A fragment, which says, I want to send a chunk of that file now. A fragment is a piece of the file. Cancel session, which means I'm giving up on this file, toss it out, and the server will say, okay, delete it. Close session, I'm done now. The file's already there. And then the server sends back ACKs to all of these messages. An ACK is the response from the server to any one of these messages. And the documentation, MSDN has fairly decent, there are a couple of bugs in it, but there are fairly decent documentation on MSDN. That is a link, so when these slides become available, I'll probably put them on my website as well, but I'm sure Cernut will put them up. When the slides become available, that will be an active link you can click on. And then there's a document in the WSPP set, the WSP set, MC, not MS, but MC-BUP. Do we care? No idea. What's the MC for? Yeah.
MC were a bunch of non-core Windows protocols that were quite support protocols. So they were originally labeled separately. In fact, actually, we stopped doing it. They're all MS these days.
Well, that one's still MC.
Yeah, correct. But there's a gradual process of conversion.
Okay. So it will eventually be MS-BUP. Who knows?
It makes you feel better.
There's about a dozen or so MCs
still. Actually, I only found the one in the WSPI. I only found the one.
There's one MCPP.
Okay.
Same, in this case, it is the same document.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Yeah, actually, you're right.
The names of all our documents are under constant. The acronyms that they use to name them, they get new editor policies.
Oh, great.
It's like using a four-digit PIN.
Right. Well, Just let me know when you change MS SIFS to MS Foo, okay?
Okay, I'll let you know.
All right. Why do we care about this? One of the reasons is that last year at this very same conference, at dinner one night, Tridge said, you know, Microsoft has published 300-something documents. I don't know how much the number.
More than that
now?
Yeah, if you include WISP and MCPP together, it's well over 400.
So well over 400 documents. And he said, we should be implementing as many of these protocols as we can. So I started with the Bs. I just started with the Bs, you know, and I thought I'd get as many as I could do.
Just wanted to get rid of you for a while.
Yeah, well, you know. It was something to do while I couldn't do SIFs, which is in the Cs, right? So I went ahead and tried to do this one. And, I wanted to be able to, keep myself involved in these docs and be able to read them and complain when there were bugs and things like that. So it's yet another Windows protocol that we've implemented, okay? Basic and simple that way. It's supported in IIS, and there's a lightweight HTTP server that Microsoft now makes available, a low-end server that also supports the BITS upload protocol. So I figured, it's a protocol that's there. Let's at least have the tools to be able to use it if we choose to. It is convenient. It's not as powerful as rsync or anything like that, but it's convenient to be able to upload a file to a BITS server, to a HTTP server that runs BITS. MS BITS also supports branch cache, and this was the other reason I was interested in it. Branch cache is what I'm really interested in. That's what we'll get to going on here. We have 10 minutes. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have to hurry. So all I have to do is add get to STIB, and I can do branch cache with STIB as a testing tool. That's my daughter when she was very young. She's 16 now but has the same attitude. So let's talk about prequel, which is where we get into branch cache. All right? So pay attention. This is where it actually gets interesting. So what the heck is prequel? It is a project to build an open source implementation of Microsoft's branch cache. So what the heck is branch cache? Who here has not heard about branch cache? Okay, we have a few. Good. All right. Branch cache is a distributed content caching system. It's supported in Windows 2008, servers. It should be W2K8R2, actually. And Windows 7 clients. What it is a cheap, effective WAN acceleration technology. Okay? I've tested it. It actually does accelerate things. Okay? It's a cheap, effective WAN acceleration technology for SMB2 and for HTTP, and by extension, if it works for HTTP, it can work for BITS. Okay? Branch cache architecture, basic pieces. There's a content server, a web server, or a SIF server, an SMB2 server, I should say. These are servers that have content to share with multiple clients, right? Clients request and receive content from the content servers. Basic and simple, client-server architecture, right? The extra piece is the cache. A copy of the original content, cryptographically tagged. It's got, little tags on it, the SHA-256, and divided into segments and blocks. And I'll explain what segments and blocks are coming up here. So the content servers, again, web servers, file servers. The client must know to ask for content tags instead of actual content. The client has to say, I can take the content, or if you want to, you can give it to me as tags. Okay? If the tags are already calculated, this is the interesting part. The way Microsoft has it implemented, when you request a file from a content server or a chunk of a file, you say, I will take the content or I will take the tags. The content server then gets that request and says, do I have the tags already calculated? If not, it just returns the content. No tags. And in the background, it starts to calculate the tags. And this can take a little while. I've done some testing, and I did the first request and the second request. The second request came back with raw content again because the tags were not yet calculated. All right? Once the tags have been calculated, if you've requested the option of tags, it will send back the tags instead of sending you the content. So you get this much shorter, the Microsoft numbers are 2,000 to 1 compression. Much shorter response than you would get if you were asking for the whole content. You could, yes. Pre-generating the tags is an option. Okay? So here is an example. I don't know if you can see that. But this is an HTTP request, and in the accept encoding, you get your usual gzip, deflate, but you also get this additional one, peer-dist. Okay? Peer-dist says, I'll accept tags. You know, notice that, you know, this HTTP, it says, I'll take gzip, just let me know that I've got gzip, and I'll unzip it before I present it to the user. In this case, it's also saying, I'll take peer-dist. I'll take the tags instead. Okay, so this is 5 minutes. This is Internet Explorer 8. So here's a basic model of the distributed cache mode. In distributed cache mode, when this client gets tags and content, because if you request the tags and you get back the tags and you go to your cache and you say, anybody got the actual content? And the answer is no. Then you go back to the server again and you say, then give me the content. You drop that peer dist from your list. And it brings back the content, and then this is to the user. The user has both now the tags and the content. So the user keeps, this client keeps both the tags and the content. So when this user makes the same request for the tags and says, anybody got it? This machine will say, yes, I've got it. And the content is now on the local LAN. Again, this is a WAN link. And it's described here, but I'll skip past it because I just said it. This is the hosted cache mode. In this case, the user here makes the request to the server, gets back the tags. The content is not on the cache. So the user makes the request for the content, gets back the content, and then takes content and tags and gives them to the cache server. In this case, you don't have to broadcast for anything. Anybody got these tags? Yes, no, you know. Instead, this user says, I want that content, gets the tags from the server. They're signed so that they know that it's the correct information. Comes back, says, anybody got, no, it doesn't have to say anybody. Asks the cache server, do you have these tags? The answer is yes. Then they get the content directly from the cache server. Okay? That's the description of hosted mode. Blocks are a unit of download. This is how much you copy. And they are 64K. The block tag is the simple SHA of the content of the block, 64K block. Usually SHA 256, although there are options in the docs. Segments are 512 blocks each. That's 32 meg. Obviously, if the last block is short, the segment will also be short. So the goals of this project, content server, yeah?
What stops you getting a block that you shouldn't have been able to see?
Well, before you can get anything from the server, you have to do whatever authentication is required.
Yeah. The cache server.
No, you have to be authenticated to the cache server. There's an authentication scheme, which I haven't gone into, but yes, you have to have authority. Right. Content server is the first step I want to do. I've almost got this working. I was working on it last night, and I looked at my code, and I'm a little bit too picky. And I said, you know, this will work, but it's ugly, and I want to rewrite it. So I gave up, and I went to bed last night. I can write a content server for Apache as a CGI script. I got 2 minutes. I can write a content server for Apache as a CGI script. It's almost done. I just have to. I'll probably finish it tomorrow. This will give us server-side code that can be used as an example to add this feature to Samba. It's really easy to add. It's not complicated to add. My next goal will be to create that hosted cache server. I think that's a very worthwhile goal. But I talked to Steve French yesterday at length about doing the pure caching piece. And he's given me some interesting challenges. He wants me to tie the pure caching in with the Linux file system caching. I don't know if it's a good idea, but we'll look at it. We'll give it a shot. I was in Potsdam just recently, and the lilacs were in bloom. Other stuff, I want to remind people that there's a thing called SIFS.org out there. I'd like more people to get involved. Just send me an email. We'll get you an account, and you can update the wiki on SIFS.org. And that is the end of my presentation. And we have a question.
You didn't mention that branch cache is integrated with SMB2. And the SMB2 client can fetch those tabs.
I did, actually. Yes.
Sorry, I was a bit asleep.
Yes, SMB2 and HTTP. HTTP is a very easy one to do initial implementation on, you know, to get familiar with the system. And so I'm just using HTTP as an easy way to get my feet wet with this. I only started this a week and a half ago, by the way, the branch cache implementation.
So is it done yet?
Probably tomorrow. The STIB code is on my website, ubix.org/proj/STIB.
Yeah, you need to know the URL. You can't navigate to it from the top level.
Can't you?
Yeah, you just get kind of a blank page that says who we are.
Oh, well, there's a project link on the top page. Click on the project link, and from there, this is, yeah. Yeah,
Sorry, guys, we have to cut this short to give the next speaker time to set up, and there are two people, so they need even more time, and we have to give you a chance to...